Good morning. First of all, welcome everyone to the Sunday morning lecture series. First, I want to wish a refuah shlema to Rabbi Yemins, who is home this morning with a fever. So we're sorry that he couldn't make it. Secondly, I want to thank a number of people that's making this morning lecture possible. First of all, sponsored by Chelkenu Initiative, Dov Simons. The Chelkenu project in general is in memory of his father, Shalom Lipa ben Lev Alter Alevi. It's dedicated to his memory. We want to thank all the folks that were involved with setting up this morning. I'm going to mention names, but if I leave someone out, please forgive me. Sue Fass, Sue Carey, Mindy Fried and her daughter Leah, Ruth Liebert, Tova and Ellie Sachs. If there's anybody else that... And Sherry Bohm, who asked not to be mentioned. Okay. We are very happy to present to you Rabbi Gil's student. I'll just tell you a little bit about him. He is currently the book editor of the OU Jewish Action magazine. He's a former managing editor of the OU Press. He also had a publishing house called Yashar Books, which he successfully sold. He is one of the original Orthodox Jewish bloggers. His blog was called Hir Hurim, otherwise known as Torah Musings. He writes prolifically about the interface between different facets of Judaism, specifically interrelationship between Orthodox Judaism and various factions within Orthodox Judaism. He serves on the executive committee of the Rabbinical Council of America, and he is on the editorial committee of Orthodox Union's Jewish Action magazine. So without further ado, I present to you Rabbi Gil Student.
Thank you. Wow, I did not expect this big of a crowd. There are source sheets on the table. Unfortunately, we don't have enough for everybody, so please share. So the topic we're discussing today is the challenges of Orthodoxy, challenges facing the Orthodox community and facing us as Orthodox Jews. There's no way I can win with this, right? Everybody has their own personal topic or a list of topics. I tried on Facebook saying, what are your top issues? And we all come up with different top issues depending on where we are in life, who we know, who we interact with, and what challenges we personally face. So I just want to set the level, the bar, very clearly. I'm not going to satisfy anyone in the room. You're all going to leave wanting more, and I apologize. We'll have plenty of time afterwards to discuss. What I'd like to do is discuss a framework of how to think about these issues that might be helpful to you. It's helpful to me, and take what you want, take what you can, and we'll talk about it afterwards. So I'd like to start out with just a first question that everyone will face at some point in their life. If not personally, then when they pay attention to the laning on Rosh Hashanah, where it says, "V'Hashem nisos Avraham." God tested Abraham, Avraham. And the obvious question is, why? Why should Hashem test anybody? Why should he test Avraham, who was a big tzaddik? Why should any of us face any challenges in our life? It's a deep question, many answers. So I'd like to focus on the answer the Ramban gives. The Ramban, and interestingly, the Kuzari as well, answers the question as follows. And if you look at the Ramban on that verse itself, on that pasuk, Vashem Yisos Avraham, why did God test Avraham? There are actually many tests that Avraham had to pass. So the Ramban says, because Hashem knew Avraham could pass it. He could pass the test. If you've ever heard the saying that God only gives us tests that we can pass, sounds a little trite, but there's truth there, and that comes from this Ramban. Hashem saw there was potential in Avraham, and he wanted Avraham to reach his full potential, so he gave them the tests to bring that potential to reality, to actualize the potential. We might not like it, when we face tests in our lives, but it brings out the best in us. And it forces us to confront difficult issues and grow and become better Jews and better people. So the first source on the sheet, the Ramban didn't make this up. So I'll read it in Hebrew and roughly translate. There's a translation that's a little archaic on the side. Hashem tzadik yivchan, God will test the righteous. Ve'ohev chamas son anafsho, and someone who loves theft, God hates. So Amar Rabbi Yonasan Hayotzer, Amar Rabbi Yonasan, Rabbi Yonasan says, Hayotzer, the potter, hazeh, eino bode kankani mera'ayim. So a potter who creates pots for clay, and he wants to test which ones he should sell. So he sees the weak ones, he's not going to start tapping on them. Because you know what happens when you tap on the weak pots? They collapse. We want, he's going to test the strong ones to see, is this good enough to sell at the market? So if you read through the midrash here, this is Bereishis Rabba Lamed Daled Beis, for anybody who doesn't have the source sheet. So Hashem is testing us. He tests the people who we know they're strong. The people who are weak, he's not going to give them tests that they won't fail, because that's just pushing them down, and Hashem doesn't want us to fail. He wants us to pass. So in real life, so in let's say in the corporate world, or just in general, in community life, so who do you give, if you have an important task that you want to get done, who do you give it to? You give it to the busiest person you know, because they're the people who get stuff done. It's in the corporate world. Sometimes you get rewarded for good work by getting more work, right? It doesn't seem fair. In the end, hopefully there's some sort of raise, promotion, bonus, or whatever. But that's just the reality of life. If you're a manager, you want to get stuff done, you give it to the people who are doing good work already, and they get more burden. And that's the same concept. Hashem tests the people he knows can pass. And this, I think, is an important concept to keep in your back pocket when you think about the challenges that Hashem poses to our community and that we face in the Orthodox community. These challenges are there for our own benefit, even if we don't see it immediately. It makes the community stronger as we recognize them, we see problems, and we try to fix them. And that's how we become stronger as a community, stronger as a family, and stronger as Klal Yisrael. These tests Hashem gives us because he knows we can pass them. A lot of people like to prophesy doom. The Orthodox, the Jewish community, Klal Yisrael is going to be around. We've been around for thousands of years. We're going to be around for another thousands of years. Whatever challenges we face, we have to keep that in perspective. That Hashem gives us these tests because he knows we can pass them. We can pass them. So community. So you're familiar with the concept of a twice a year Jew. We say some kind of, because we come to shul every Shabbos, most of us every day, multiple times during the week we're in shul, whether it's for a shir, for a minyan, or for to set up the food. We come for many reasons, and we say deridingly to about a twice a year Jew, they only come in on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and maybe it's not fair, because the pasuk says. It's in the Haftarah that we read on fast days. Yeshu Hashem behimatzo. Seek out God when he can be found. And the Gemara says, when can Hashem be found? That's the 10 days starting with Rosh Hashanah and ending Yom Kippur. So when should you seek out God? Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. That's twice a year Jew. So the Gemara asks Akasha, this is the second source. This is a list of questions posed to Yishayahu HaNavi. The Gemara has. One of them is Yishayahu was the one who said, Yishayahu Hashem himself, seek out God when he can be found. And they say, but Moshe Rabbeinu said, Mika Hashem Elokeinu b'chol koreinu ayilav. Moshe Rabbeinu said that Hashem is there for us all year round, not just twice a year. Then Yishayahu says, only in those 10 days, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. So how could it be? So the Gemara answers, Ha b'yachid, ha b'tzibur. For an individual, it's very tough to reach out to Hashem. And during those 10, that unique period of time, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, so that's when we as individuals can reach out easily to Hashem. But in a community, any day of the week, any week of the year, Hashem is there for the community. That's what the community gives to us. If we're stuck on our own, trying to daven, we live in Alaska and there's no shul within 50 miles, so then it's a little tough. We are on our own to inspire ourselves, to get the davening going. You know, you're tired in the morning, you show up in shul, and then you get into the rhythm of it. If you're on your own, you don't have that rhythm, you have to create the rhythm yourself. It's very hard. The community gives that to us. At Baruch Hashem, we have a beautiful shul here, many shuls in this community, where every day you have people getting each other into the rhythm. we help each other out of the community to reach out to Hashem every single day, every single week. It's beautiful. So why is community so powerful? Why does community inspire us and make us better people and better Jews? So there are multiple reasons. The Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim in Spain. So after the Black Plague decimated Europe, he gave a series of sermons to encourage the Jewish community, what remained of the Jewish community after the Black Plague. It's published in a sefer called Drashas HaRan, the Sermons of the Ran, and it is, in my opinion, one of the most accessible works of medieval Jewish philosophy. It speaks like a drasha, like a midrash, like all these tzukim, doesn't use obscure terminology. It's very inspiring, very relatively easy to read in Hebrew. I don't know if there is in English. So in the very first drasha, he asks this question. What did the Dor HaFlaga, right? They're trying to build this Tower of Babel, reach up to sky. What did they do wrong? The Torah doesn't actually mention a sin there. There's no sin. So all the commentators work hard to figure out what the sin is. Why were they dispersed? What did they do wrong that they had to be dispersed throughout the land? So he suggests as follows. Every individual has flaws and has positives, benefits, unique good attributes and bad attributes. So on our own, we're good and bad, right? We try to emphasize the good, and when you put everybody together. So if you're all trying to do something bad, so all the bad traits in everybody, someone is an evil plotter, someone is very sinister in getting things done, all the bad traits of everybody combine to create one big group of badness, of evil. Evil is not a bunch of evil people. It's a bunch of regular people who get together and combine, get each other, do evil. I mean, that's, what do they call it? The banality of evil, referring to the Holocaust? Most of these people weren't evil. It's just everything bad in them came out when they combined together. So the Ram says, why were they dispersed? When they got together to do evil. They didn't actually do anything wrong. But Hashem had to disperse them before they were able to do terrible things. That power of evil together was just too powerful. The Ram says the same thing with the community when people get together to do good. I'm not a tzaddik. Maybe someone in this room is a tzaddik. I suppose most of us are not tzaddikim, but the good in us is emphasized and combined when we all get together in one room together to do good. That's the power of a community. We're all flawed, but when we combine our good traits together, we can get amazing things accomplished. When I was in school, I grew up in the 80s, and there were like these television commercials, don't give in to peer pressure. Right? There were all sorts of, in those days, I don't know what they have nowadays, no, there were all sorts of television commercials, some by the Mormons, and some by, don't tell a lie. There were all sorts of wonderful, good, wholesome lessons, and one of them was don't give in to peer pressure. Why not? Because my mother always says, you know, if everybody's jumping off the George Washington Bridge, I grew up near the George Washington Bridge, everybody's jumping off the bridge, you're going to jump off also? No. But there's a positive aspect to peer pressure. When Rabbi Yochanan was dying on his deathbed, this is a third source, Brachos Daf Chaf Ches Amud Beis. Ukshirchala Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Nichnasu Talmidov Levakra. So his students came to visit him, pay him a last visit, hear some last words of wisdom for the Rebbe. Amar lo Rabbeinu Bachenu, give us a last bracha, a last blessing, the last time we're going to see you. And he said to them, Amar lahem yehi ratzon, Shetemora Shemayim Aleichem, may be the will of Hashem, that your fear of heaven should be Kemora Basov Adam, like your fear of other people. And they said, Amar lo Talmidov, Adkan, that's it? Really? You can't give us more? Shouldn't our fear of heaven be the most powerful fear ever? Hashem is all powerful. The gateway to Gan Eden is through Hashem. And all we're supposed to do is be scared of him like our neighbor? So answered Rabbi Yochanan, Halavai. Teiduk she'adam over avera, when someone does something wrong, Omer shelo yirani adam. I hope nobody sees me. You know who always sees you? Hashem always sees you. The peer pressure can also work in a positive way. And in a community, let's face it, sometimes we have all sorts of pressures. We don't want to be seen going into that restaurant. We don't want to be seen doing something, being in some inappropriate place. But you know what? Hashem's always watching. But halavai, we should take that peer pressure, that community pressure, to do good. You know, I live in Brooklyn, and the peer pressure there is very often overwhelming, and people complain about it. And they're right. Keeping up with the Joneses, the Schwartzes, whatever you call it, I'm not a fan of that. I don't have fancy suits, fancy cars. I'm not a fancy kind of guy. I don't believe in that whatsoever. However, the bulk of peer pressure is to go to shul every morning, to do mitzvot, to make sure that our kids go to yeshiva and wear yarmulkes and tzitzis and all sorts of good things. Peer pressure can be bad, but it could also be very good. And that's a very powerful. Our community is the envy of the entire country. I speak to a lot of Christians, and they're struggling. And they say, they look at the Orthodox community and they say, this is incredible. You're tight-knit. You all reinforce positive aspects and attributes in each other. They want to imitate us. It's a beautiful thing. It changes my perspective on the community. So before we start speaking about the challenges of Orthodoxy, I'd just like to point out a few of the positives. Number one, and from here, by the way, the challenges come very quickly. Family-oriented. Beautiful. People with their family, their kids, generation to generation. We transmit the tradition that we've had for thousands of years. I was just speaking to a cousin of mine who remembers my grandfather, who I barely remember, and goes back even future generations. I know where my paternal grandparents, I'm reading now a book I read in Hebrew, it was translated to English. Still alive, someone who remembers the shtetl my father's parents came from in Poland. And he's going detailed. He remembers the shoemaker. He remembers this guy. It's incredible. And I can give that. I don't usually talk about my family in public, but I'll tell you, I recently had my first grandchild born, a granddaughter. Thank you. This book is going to my granddaughter. Think of all the generations that go through there. And I'm a young man, but because there's a family orientation in the community, I got married young. My daughter got married young. And it's a beautiful, wonderful thing. And I'm not trying to brag about my family. It's look around in the community. It's beautiful. We manage in this day and age where society is collapsing around us, we manage to have kids and grandchildren who are wholesome, who are loving, who are respectful. My kids are not respectful 100% of the time. I'm not. But you got to have perspective a little bit. It's beautiful. The minute you have a child, your perspective changes. Because instead of it being all about you, it becomes all about them. No one is ready to become a parent. I was terrified. Every first time parent is terrified. You cry. How am I supposed to tell anyone to do what? Tell anyone what to do? I'm not perfect. I've got all these flaws. But you know what? The minute the kid is born, it makes sense. You figure it out. It comes naturally. And it's beautiful, and it changes your perspective. Number one. Number two, education. I tell my coworkers, I work in insurance, and I tell my coworkers that my kids learn Hebrew when they're 4 years old, learn to read Hebrew before they learn to read English. Their minds are blown. I sit on the subway, I live in New York, I sit in the subway, and I have a Hebrew book open to me. I cannot tell you over the past 20 years how many times someone non-Jewish says, is that Hebrew? Wow. I've always wanted to read the Bible in the original. And you know, sometimes it rarely actually is a Bible. Usually it's something else. But they're amazed. The education that our kids can read Hebrew. Okay, we live in the Art Scroll Age. I didn't grow up in the Art Scroll Age. But even still, they learn Aleph Beis before they learn the ABC. And that's been going on for thousands of years. And with all the complaints we have about our schools, and I just mentioned Art Scroll, my kids don't have the fluency in Hebrew that I do. It's still remarkable the amount of material they learn. And the joke is, education is what remains after you forget everything they taught you. The amount that we retain from our day school and high school education is remarkable. We blow away so many other communities in our connection to Tanakh, to medieval. I have a book of medieval Jewish philosophy. People are like, medieval? Wow. But we have it all the time. We have Rambams on our shelves. This is very common for us. The community has shiurim. More often than you even think about. Daf Yomi, during the week, Shabbos. We have a 5 minute after davening, 5 minute before davening. The rabbi sneaks something in when you're not looking. It happens all the time. We have such a focus on learning in the community. There are more people in yeshiva now than there have been historically, probably all the generations combined. It's incredible that the age that we live in, and the, you know, when my grandparents were growing up, so you're in yeshiva, you're in cheder, to what, 12 years old, and they go out and you're apprenticed or you work in the store. Nowadays, it's very common. After high school, you spend a year in yeshiva in Israel, and after that, the year turns into 2 years, and then you maybe you go to YU, or you find something else, you live near, you go to Baltimore, there are all sorts of opportunities. The learning now, and sustaining kolel a year or two after marriage, it's growing very common. It's incredible, mind-blowing. And then they go out to work. It's very rare in our community, in general, for someone to be learning in Kollel for more than 10 years, even in Lakewood. But those years in Kollel create a focus in the couple and the family and in the next generation who are born then or who hear the stories about the focus on Torah, learning Torah. And more, so there's a routine, the calendar throughout the year, right? It creates routine. Anything you learn about parenting is that kids thrive when they have a routine. Where adults also thrive when they have a routine. Some of the routine, you know, frustrates us. Pesach is coming already, right? But it's the same cycle year over year, and it creates a routine, it creates a structure in which we can grow and learn and improve. Every Seder is better than the previous one. Every Purim is less drunk than the previous one. And stability, support system, you know, one of the unthanked and unrecognized beauties of the community is a chevra kadisha. We should never need them, but we all do at some point in our lives. And they're there for us all the time. Day, night, my brother-in-law never sleeps. He's on the chevra kadisha. Sometimes the whole night, he'll be going from one tara to another and then go to work in the morning straight. You know, this happens in every community. And it has to happen. And it's a beautiful thing. We take care of our own. We take care of each other in the community. Okay, that's not what you came to hear, though. So I'd like to give you a general idea that helps me a lot when dealing with particular problems and with just understanding philosophically, theologically, hashkafically, Torah and the challenges that we face. This is source 4. It's from Mori Nevuchim. Chelek Gimel. Perek Lamed Daled. If you don't know this idea, this will blow your mind. Mashatzarich Shetedu, what you have to know, Gamkin, Shehatorah Lo Sabi Ladavar Hazar Lo Siya Hatorah Kefiya Inyan Hamuat. The Torah does not look at the unusual occurrence, at the minority, at the exceptional case. Avakol Mashi Yirza Lalamdo Midas Omido Omaisa Moel. Anything that the Torah tries to teach us, whether it's information, whether it's a positive attribute, or whether it's a good action, some sort of good act that will help us. It looks at the majority of people and tries to fit it into their lives. The Torah does not look at the minority, at the unusual case. And not to the damage that the Torah can do to an individual. According to this idea or this practice, this Torah practice. Ki ha-Torah he-inyan Eloki. The Torah is divine. It's an ideal. Ve'alach ha-livchon ha-inyanim ha-tivim asher toheles ha-hem ha-kolos ha-nim sozba. Think about the laws of nature. Yesh v'cholam. Let's go out of here. I'll give you an example. Think of the laws of nature. The laws of Torah, they're like the laws of nature. If you live in Israel, what you want most is rain. If you live in the Middle East, water is so important for you to drink, for the animals to drink, for the fruits, for all the crops. Nothing can function in the world, and particularly in the Middle East, without water. If you're traveling on a dirt road in a wagon, when it's raining, water is bad for you. Water, you curse out the water. Same with Torah. Torah applies to the majority of people and the majority of circumstances, but there are exceptions. There are people. So men put on tefillin on their left arm, right? If you're lefty, you put it on your right arm. What if you only have one arm? What if you have no arms? There are people like that. In my shul, there's a blind man. He was never tzaddik. Wow. I mean, we're so lucky, privileged to have him in our midst, in our shul. He never learned how to put on tefillin, and he can only put on tefillin when he comes to shul, and someone puts tefillin on him. And if he misses Shacharis, he comes to shul for mincha, and someone puts the tefillin on him for mincha. So he's an exception. But still, we are all obligated. I remember Rav Aaron Soloveitchik had a stroke in the early 80s, and he lived till the late 90s. I used to daven behind him in yeshiva when I was in YU. Someone put tefillin on him, on his left arm. He would scream in agony, the pain he had from having someone put tefillin on him. But he did it anyway. The Torah didn't work for him. But he stuck with it anyway. Because the Torah works for the majority of people who have not had that stroke and that debilitating illness to the left arm. And he didn't even use the right arm. His right arm was fine. He had someone put it on his left arm and scream. You're not allowed to talk when you're putting on tefillin. But it was the Mesiris Nefesh. The horror, we were terrified. But the Mesiris Nefesh was awe-inspiring. And to see him struggle with that, it teaches us, gives me perspective on the challenges that I face in my life. So who's left out, according to this Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim? Who's left out? The minorities. The people who don't fit in. We're talking about community, family, beauty of transmission. So not everybody is married. Not everybody is able to get married. Some people, whether it's they just never succeeded in finding a shidduch, whether it's that their sexual orientation does not allow them to get married, whether they're mentally challenged, they're emotionally challenged, some people just not fit. So I used to work with a guy, not Jewish, he didn't have kids, and he freely volunteered that he would be a terrible parent, he hates kids, and he and his wife decided they're never going to have kids because they don't want to torture kids in that way. Now, I'm not his rabbi, so I didn't advise him on anything, but I took advisement from that not everybody is fit to have children. And we see the law, it's in the law, the secular law. Child Protective Services will take children away from people who are not fit to raise them. It's a danger to the kids. So the Torah doesn't work for these people. So the only thing we can do, they're the travelers in the muddy road, their wagon is stuck, and the community, the chaverim, have to come out and unstuck the wheel. They have chaverim in Philadelphia who come out and they help you help the travelers. So we as a community have to help them in whatever way we can to help them go on their way, even though it's not going to work for them. But the Rambam says these laws of Torah are like laws of nature. You can't change gravity no matter how much you don't like it, and we can't change the laws of Torah no matter how much we don't like it. An understanding of where they are and love. If you have to help people out of love and care. Otherwise, it's just not going to work. And number two, when you help them, you have to make sure not to hurt the majority. You have to do it in a way that is thoughtful and that continues this toelus, this objective, this positive aspect of the community that the Torah was intended to provide. How to do that? Don't know. So we're talking about Dirshu Hashem Behimatso. So one other thing that Behimatso, when seek out God where he is, when he's available, is look for God where he is on his terms. And I don't mean this physically. God does not exist in one place. I mean it hashkafically, theologically. Hashem set the terms. We have to reach out to Hashem on his terms, not on our terms. So let's talk about the biggest challenge that I see in the community. The biggest challenge to Orthodoxy. Everyone in here is going to disagree, but I'm the speaker right now. You'll have your turn. The biggest challenge I find is the crisis of confidence in Orthodoxy itself. Some people are troubled by the hashkafa. Doesn't seem right, whether it's on issues of gender, sexual orientation, and then on issues of basic faith, of history, of biblical criticism, Talmudic criticism, all sorts of different hashkafic issues that could be there. Other people think the community structure just itself is corrupt. It's unfair. The rich, that's the golden rule. Whoever has the gold makes the rules. Who gets honored at all those dinners, right? Just the people who donate the most. If the rich people get the kavod, get the honor, and they're the ones who are able to pick up the phone and get a kid into school. They get the principal on the phone immediately. They have the connections. They have the power. They set the rules. I'm exaggerating. It's not true. It's an exaggeration. I was just at my shul Malava Malka last night, and they honored the guy who's the most active in the shul, period. Not the richest guy. It's a beautiful thing. Most yeshiva dinners have different honors. Some are for the richest guy. And some are for the most active parent, the parents of the year. The community is not all bad, but there's truth to it. It's not a lie. I can't get a principal on the phone, but if I had $1 million, I could get a principal. In my high school, just for one example, there was one guy, good friend of mine, the biggest troublemaker you will ever meet. He's been expelled from school so many times, and every time there's another plaque in the somewhere where he comes back in when there's a plaque up. And I don't resent it, because I've never had to run a yeshiva before. And I never had to pay salaries, I never had to make payroll, and it's not easy. But it's demoralizing to those of us who are just plain people. I have a blog, so now I have reach, and maybe principals are scared I might blog about them or something like that so I can get them on the phone. Not from when we're recording, I have a good story about that, but different time. That's one. Unfair. But then there's also that leadership seems incompetent. There are certain basic, obvious things they should be doing that they're not. You hear it at every Shabbos table. So unfair. If you've ever talked to people in leadership positions, their ears are wide open. They say, tell us your ideas. And honestly, if anything you get from this talk right now is when you leave, if you have a good idea, call someone up, send an email to someone at the OU, at the whatever, the Vada Rabbanim, or whoever you're trying to advise, they want to hear it. But think it through, please. Most people have ideas that are completely unrealistic, unthought through. If you're in a leadership position, you have to think, what's coming in a year, 2 years, 5 years? What's going to be the result? If you play chess, you understand. You can't just move a piece. You just move a piece here, move a piece there. You're done in three moves because they'll checkmate you immediately. If you're in a leadership position, you have to be thoughtful. You have to understand all the different constituents, all the gives and takes, and what comes next. So, but I tell you, I personally got a job in a community organization by sending criticism to one of the head people. That's how I got a job. I worked at the OU. I would occasionally email Rabbi Ganak and say, I think you handled this wrong. And he said, call me up. And we talked, and we talked it through, and he said, no. Sometimes he said yes. Sometimes he said, write it up. Let me see. Think it through. And you know what? He liked it. We had a good rapport. He liked my ideas. He hired me. And we argued almost every day. But they want to hear these ideas. They're not all powerful. They're not all knowing. They're not all thinking. They're open to ideas. What they're not open to is kvetching. Kvetching takes a lot of time. It's not productive at all. If you have ideas, think how it can be implemented. Be productive. And I'm not saying everyone in a leadership position in the community is wonderful. They're not. Some people are horrible. Some people have gotten there through nepotism, through money, or whatever. But there are plenty of good people who want to hear. You have to deal with the good and the bad. Be realistic. Everyone in this room can be a community leader in your own way. But putting that aside, and when the recording's not on, I could give you a list of complaints about people who are doing things wrong and what I think they should be doing. And you know what? It's not that I'm necessarily right on any of these issues. It's when you pack them all together, it just creates this lack of confidence and this demoralization, like everything is horrible. Let me read to you something. I just read this, came across my desk about a week ago. Nowadays, everybody writes their own personal story and publishes it online. You know, you get into the newspapers and things like that. I'm not a personal story kind of guy, but people love this. So this is one person's personal story. His conversion and his learning, he went to yeshiva, and then he got disillusioned. So listen to this, these two paragraphs. The idea behind Orthodox Jewish law, as I have come to understand it, is that the contemporary consensus of rabbis determines the will of God. So I disagree with that off the bat. Right. Yet here I saw what my own conscience and intellect declared to be wrong-headed, harmful legal decisions. This was not the only example, of course. I was disturbed by many other decisions the mainstream rabbinate was making with regards to agunot, women's participation in synagogues, as well as conversion standards, among other pressing issues. I came to the inescapable conclusion that the rabbis could not be trusted to follow the will of God and the intent of the Torah, or even to honestly follow the precedents of rabbinic tradition without their decisions being tainted by politics. It's all about politics. And from this followed another more disturbing conclusion. If the rabbis of the present could not be trusted, why should I trust the rabbis of the past, who created the whole framework of Orthodox life? Within about 2 months, I had abandoned Orthodox Judaism and any plan to be a rabbi. So this is someone who was all focused on what's wrong with the community. If you read the headlines of the newspapers, that's all you get. It's horrible. It's bad. It's not social media. Don't let people tell you social media is ruining it. Over 100 years ago, we had yellow journalism. When I was a kid, there was no social media, but the headlines of every newspaper anywhere was how terrible it is, how horrible it is. You know the old joke of in Germany before the war, someone was reading the Nazi newspaper, a Jewish person, and Yankel came over and said, Moshe, why are you reading this? He said, well, if I read the Jewish newspaper, everything's wrong. If I read the Nazi newspaper, the Jews control everything. So if you read the Jewish newspaper, thing after this is wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, and it just destroys us inside. And what we need to do is to keep perspective that, first of all, not every story in the newspaper is right. It's designed to sell stories. Scandal sells. There are scandals, but for every scandal, there are dozens and dozens of wonderful schools, wonderful rabbis, wonderful people, wonderful teachers who are doing everything right, but they don't get in the newspaper. And when you allow it to chip away at you like that, it chips away not only at your faith in the community, it chips away in your faith in Chazal, in everything that's sacred in life, in the Torah, and in Hashem. So I'm not saying ignore the scandals. Chas v'shalom. I'm not saying ignore the things that are wrong. We need to fix them. I'm saying keep perspective. The crisis of confidence is debilitating. But when you think about it, when you take a step back, you say, I love my community. I love my shul. I love that we could get 70 people out on a Sunday morning just to hear some schnuck from Brooklyn come talk. It's beautiful. If we take away this language of crisis, we can actually manage with a lot of these problems. So let's take the case, the off the derech crisis that we have. I was speaking about a year ago at an interfaith Christian-Jewish gathering, and I said the best estimates are that the Orthodox Jewish community loses about 15 to 20% of its youth. The jaws dropped. They said, that's incredible success. They can't believe it. In this day and age, that any community could have that success with this, the wealthiest society in the world that we live in. We live in the flesh pot of the world with every joy and pleasure is available to you, and we managed to keep 80 to 85% of our youth. And we talk about it as a crisis, because you know why? I believe in a neshama. I believe in an olam haba. And if wild psak halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, if someone is going to leaving the community on Shabbos to convert to Christianity, to leave observance, pikuach nefesh, you can violate Shabbos to save them. This is halacha l'maisa today. If you can stop someone from leaving Torah observance on Shabbos, violate Shabbos. Every rabbi will tell you that. Circumstances vary. Don't exaggerate things in your mind. You need someone with a measured perspective to guide you on that. But for sure, because this is a matter of life and death. Neshama is real. Olam haba is real. If one of I daven with tears throughout the years for my kids that they should remain from. And everybody should do that. Tehillim. My wife Tehillim is full of tears. I'm a Litvak, so for me to say Tehillim is very hard. My son was 3 years old, he had a surgery in the hospital, and I was in the waiting room, one of these in and out on one day, right? Everybody's there sitting Tehillim, and I didn't understand. I had a Gemara in front of me. And that was how I reached out to Hashem. But sometimes I do say Tehillim for my kids. I daven, I cry. We should all cry for our kids that they should remain from. Whether to the right, to the left, you know, they should be on the Derech Hashem. It's a tragedy when any one person leaves the Derech Hashem. But, let's keep perspective. When my parents were growing up, even before that, Chaim Nachman Bialik, Kulam, one of his great poems, Kulam Nasa Derech, Kulam Azav Derech, he's sitting in yeshiva, and he writes a poem, I usually know it by heart, but I'm lost my train of thought, Levadi. Kulam Nasa Haruach, Kulam Shachaf Haor. Everybody's leaving the base medrash to be socialist, communist, going off the derech. They maybe had a 10-15% retention rate, 80-85% leaving orthodoxy. My grandmother used to tell me about Poland between the wars. Very rare to see a kid who continued, Hasidish your parents. I see my great-grandparents, the pictures of them, the long beards and the hats and the this and the that. Most of the kids went off. We are lucky. We have tremendous, we talk about this off the derech crisis. I think of it as a huge success. And many of the kids I see in Brooklyn, after 5 to 10 years, they come back. My brother-in-law's friends, almost all of them, did all sorts of bad things I don't want to know about. That's what he kept telling me. You don't want to know what we're doing. But they all have kids. They all live in a front community. They all go to shul. They all go send the kids to yeshiva. Not all, most of them. When we take away the word crisis, we realize it's a challenge that we can handle and we can deal with. We won't have 100% success, but we can have better success if we don't freak out and we react calmly and thoughtfully. I totally lost track of time, so I'm just going to keep going because I have a lot to say. Older singles. That's a problem. It's a big problem. Anyone who tries to solve it without recognizing the basic fact that throughout Western society, people are getting married older, is going to fail. You're setting yourself up for failure. It's a global problem. It's a societal problem. It's not a problem in the shidduch system. It's a problem in society at large, and society seeps into us. We're not hermetically sealed from the world, and we shouldn't be. But you got to keep that in mind. So let me do a little math for you. The best statistics I found, I don't know if it's true, but we'll just use big numbers, is that there are 50,000 births, Jewish births in America each year. 50,000, give or take. How many of those are Orthodox? Well, for round numbers, let's say 30%. Orthodox people are 10% of the Jewish community. Let's say we have more kids, so let's say 30%. 15,000 Orthodox kids a year. How many are modern Orthodox? Let's say 25%. I think that's high. Let's say 25%. So that's between 3,000 and 4,000. Let's say 4,000 is a very high estimate. 4,000 modern Orthodox kids are born a year. We'll work with that number. How many are boys? How many are girls? 50-50. 2,000 girls and boys born a year. Okay, so how many are modern Orthodox machmir? Which means they're very strict in Shabbos and Yontif and Kashrus and Negia and Sneas and all that. I don't know. So let's say 25%. So now we're down to 500. How many are introverts? They're quiet. They like to sit at home rather than be very active and up, and they're up on their feet all the time. We'll say 50%. 125. Sorry, 250. Went from 500 to 250. How many are in your range of attraction, right? You have to be attracted to your spouse. You don't have to be infatuated, but you have to be attracted. Let's say 50%. Some people are more attractive, some people less. And they have to be attracted to you, right? That has to be mutual attraction. 50%. So you're down to 125. How many live in the greater New York area? Let's say 80%. So we're down to 100. So if you're a modern Orthodox machmir girl, you will have 100 boys of your age to find a shidduch with. Let's say there's a four-year range, 400 in the greater New York area. How do you find them? Millions of people in New York City alone. How do you find those 400? I don't have an answer. One thing, easy thing, for anyone to do is to expand your horizons. If you're a modern Orthodox machmir, go a little to the left, a little to the right. Say, I'm not set in my ways. I could be a little more yeshivish. I could put on a black hat if I need to. I could put on a knitted yarmulke if I need to. I don't really care. As long as I set up a family that's from and then observes the mitzvahs the way I like to, that probably triples or quadruples your possibilities. That has to be on both sides. The girls and the boys both have to think that way. I knew when I was dating, I dated a girl from Stern, I dated a girl from Prospect Park, yeshivish, modern, I was open, and it worked very quickly for me. My daughter also, she dated a guy from Lakewood, she was open to YU, and she found a guy relatively quickly. If you open up your possibilities, so it's not a shidduch crisis per se, it's a pickiness crisis. And I don't mean that in the negative sense that, oh, you want someone who eats the pickles, likes the same kind of pickles that you do. That's terrible, horrible, or the same tablecloth that it needs to be, whatever. I'm not talking about that at all. I think most people are sane. I'm talking about normal choices and how you want to live your life. Be open to possibilities. You don't have to live in Brooklyn the rest of your life. You don't have to live in Lakewood. You don't have to live in Philadelphia. You can move to Baltimore. You can go to Atlanta. There are all sorts of options. And even not a big front community. You can move to Cherry Hill. I know, I'm not joking. I know that's greater Philadelphia anyway. But you can move out to Omaha, Nebraska. There are front people. There are a lot of front communities. You can move to Eretz Yisrael. You should move to Eretz Yisrael.
You should?
Absolutely. Everyone should move to Eretz Yisrael. Ask your rabbi for details. So let's we have two more sources here. We don't have much more time. So I'd like to pose a question for you. The pasuk says, "Emes me eretz tismach." Truth will come from the ground. So a simple kasha, not really a good kasha, but it also says, "Hashemayim shemayim l'Hashem ve'aretz nosan livnei adam." So the heavens belong to God, and the earth belongs to us. So we all know truth, the ultimate indisputable truth, is the Torah, which comes from heaven. So how can it say that truth comes from the ground when the ground is for us, not for Hashem? There are many ways to answer it. It's not such a great question. I'd like to answer it as follows. There are two types of truth. There's theoretical truth, ideal truth, ideas that are true, and then there's practical truth. So what does practical truth mean? So I'd like to spend the rest of our time discussing that. There's a challenge that the medieval philosophers faced that only a medieval philosopher could care about. And that is, how can we describe Hashem in any way using any terms? Rachum, Chanun, Merciful, full of grace. How could we even say that? How could we say God is full of chesed? Hashem is indivisible. You can't, therefore, any attributes imply that he is divisible into different parts. Right, okay. Doesn't really bother any of us. But that was a big kasha, and then day that was a kasha. And there are many different answers. The Rambam ends with his famously complex answer that any time we describe Hashem, we're really describing the opposite of what Hashem is not. There's another answer, many answers. One answer is that when we describe Hashem, we're describing Hashem's actions. So just we say Hashem is merciful, it means his actions show mercy. When we say that Hashem is true, Chosma Hashem HaKadosh Baruch Hu is emes, Hashem's seal is truth. It means that Hashem acts, his actions display truth. So our actions should also display truth. And in that way, the truth will come from us when we act with truth, even though the ultimate truth of Torah comes from Hashem. So let's look at this fifth Rambam, source 5. The Rambam at the very beginning of Mor Nevuchim. This is the second chapter, which is really just a continuation of the first. This is how he ends the beginning of Mor Nevuchim. I think this chapter is extremely relevant to people nowadays. So he was asked this kasha by a troublemaker, a medieval wise aleck. Says, if you look at Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, they ate the fruit of knowledge of good and bad, and they were punished. So before that, they didn't have knowledge of good and bad. They were basically just animals working on instinct. Then they knew good and bad, and God punished them. Doesn't make any sense. Who is this God who's punishing us? He doesn't want us to know anything. He wants us to be animals. That was a wise aleck's question. The Rambam says, you don't understand thing. You're just trying to ask kashas. You don't really want an answer. You're just being cynical. But here's the answer that he gives. There was truth before Adam and Chava ate from the fruit. They had truth and falsehood. There is nothing inherently bad about being naked. And before they ate from the fruit, they were naked and they were okay with it. Well, tell me logically what's wrong with it. I can't give you a logical answer. They were pure, logical people. Their desire caused them to eat that fruit, and when the desire took over, they became biased. They were only interested in good and bad, what's pleasing. And nakedness is pleasing, it's not pleasing, it's inappropriate, so that's bad. Once they ate from the fruit, Christians have this one idea of original sin. For us, original sin is taking bias and being led by our biases to misunderstand truth and false. And then everything is based on consensus. What's inappropriate? Well, you know what the Supreme Court said. I know it when I see it. That's pornography. I know it when I see it. It's based on consensus, on what we think, what we agree. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's what we live in. If we were true people of logic and reason, we would be able to prove it logically. There's good, and there's truth, and there's falsehood. But we're tainted for life. We are all biased people. And you don't need me to say this. I'm not an expert on science. I'm not an expert on postmodernism. If you read any article, they'll tell you even the scientific method is biased. What hypotheses get tested and what don't? That's a bias. A lot of these, aside from the fact that many supposedly repeatable tests and repeatable studies are not repeatable, that's a separate issue. But there's an inherent bias of what gets funded, what research gets funded and what doesn't. And that's with science, with everything else. Literary criticism. That's pure speculation and what seems right to us. And with our biases, we're not at the apex of logic and reason. None of us are Mr. Spock. A lot of the hashkafic challenges that we face are because of this bias. Not that I'm saying that these scholars are foolish. They're doing their best. But they are human. They're humans after the sin. And therefore, they are biased. The only thing we have that is not biased is what came directly from Hashem, and that's the Torah. So there are two ways to get around bias. One is, and the Rambam talks about this a lot, is to try to get rid of your desires. Become an ascetic. Don't eat the bagels and cream cheese and lox. I tell you now, right after you already ate. None of us are good at that. Not in this generation, and I don't recommend it to everybody. Because it's easy to crack under the pressure of all this wonderful pleasures that we have all around us. But if you look at, let's say, Rav Steinman, who has recently passed away, Rav Eliyashiv, who passed away a few years ago, they lived a Spartan lifestyle, which is mind-boggling. And it's not only Charedim. I've been told, Amos Chacham, of the Dat Mikra commentary, wrote a lot of the Dat Mikra. He also lives a Spartan lifestyle. He has, I think, some sort of a wooden bed that he lives on. I don't know. I've just been told. Very simple lifestyle, which I could not bear, that helps tear away the inherent biases that we have to what's comfortable, what seems right to us. So I can't go there. Most of us can't go there. What we can do is we can look to the great Chachamim throughout the generations who could go there. And who try, you do their best to get around their bias. So we think, oh, these rabbis, it's all politics. You know what? First of all, there is politics. And whenever you have two people in a room, there's going to be politics. And we shouldn't forget that. We should think the rabbis are unique in having politics. I mean, for crying out loud, this is a shul. If you think the notion of politics, you're not involved. But they try their best to get around the bias. And we have to try our best. Part of that is talking to others. If you see a lot of the responsa from the 20th century, very often when there's a controversial subject, they say, I think this is what the right answer is, but I won't officially paskin, I won't officially rule, till I hear from other people, some of my colleagues. I want the other Gedolei Torah, these other giants of Torah, to offer their opinion. If they agree with me, then I'm good. But if I'm the only one going in this direction, I'm worried. I have my own personal flaws. I'm not willing to do that. Chief among them are modern Orthodox posting like the three-day ish with Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. If you look through his response, he came through very interesting, original ideas But he said, look, first I've got to talk to the other rabbis. Because number one, I want to make sure I'm not causing problems to another community. And number two, I want to make sure that I got it right. These are difficult questions that our neshamos rely on it. Some of them are life and death questions, and it's a lot to shoulder. And all of us, when I get involved in any issue, I go and talk to other people. People I think are smart and understand it. And people who are big Talmidei Chachamim, even Gedolei Torah, because I'm a little concerned about my own biases. We're all governed by anecdotes. There's no data, by the way, on the Orthodox community. Almost none. I've tried. I'm actually in the process of collecting data, and it's a challenge. We all are governed by anecdotes, by the people in our circle. The wider your circle, the more anecdotes you have. The plural of anecdotes, the statisticians say, the plural of anecdotes is not data. So we're all biased based on where we live, who we know, and who we talk to. And the only answer is travel around and talk to more people. So whenever I feel challenged or I think an idea, something is going wrong, you talk to people. Find out, what do you think? What do you think? What do you think? Have you ever noticed that, we're talking about acting in truth, that if you were a social action, social justice activist, you could start an organization like that. There are entrepreneurs, there are organizations, there are funds, there are donors looking for people to give money to. If you're a modern Orthodox activist, you want to start Chalkenu or something like that, there are, I figure it out, I'll let you know how to start a 501c3, start your own nonprofit. There should be funders getting up and giving us money, saying, fix the problem. We have a beautiful community. We have a wonderful community. There are a lot of easy fixes that can be done. Please do it. I don't know. I don't know why it's not happening. There's something wrong with us that we've given into the cynicism. We've given into the defeatism, thinking that all is lost. Nobody cares. We're all on our own. And you know, we're not all on our own. So let's look at the source 6. We'll end with this, I guess. But before we go to source 6, I just want to say one other thing. When I say act in truth and try to fix things, it's not only the community that needs fixes. It's us. We need to think about ourselves. It's not just wait till the twice a year where we have Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. We think about what we can do better. I think everyone in this room works for a living, unless you're retired. You face the daily grind of getting up, going to work, struggling to pay tuition, struggling to pay to coach your food. Where do you have time for spirituality? It's your responsibility. No one else. Don't blame the community if you're not inspired. It's your responsibility. There's shiurim. There's shul. Take out a sitter. Rabbi Jonathan Sachs' translation of the sitter is beautiful and uplifting. Read it. Inspire yourself, because nobody is responsible for inspiring you other than yourself. I mean, I understand the rabbi gets paid a salary, but he's got a lot of obligations. If you just go to work and come home every day, and then you get into Shabbos exhausted and just sleep through it, it's not the community that's letting you down, it's you letting yourself down. Pick something you didn't learn in yeshiva. Tanakh. Did anyone learn all of Tanakh from beginning to end in yeshiva? No. Never happened. So learn it. It's not hard. Very, very easy. Tefillah, hashkafa, a lot of svarim. I said drashot zaran. I don't think it's in English, but find a chavrusa, learn drashot zaran. Find a shiur to attend or download yutorah.org. Lots of things. So I just want to end with source number 6. Amar Reb Shimon ben Lakish. Umazo kegefin nimshala. Klal Yisrael is compared to a grapevine. Zmuro sheba. Elu balabatim. The branches are the rich people. It says aristocracy in the English translation. Don't believe it. It's the rich people. Eshkolo sheba. The clusters. Elu tamidei chachamim. The Torah scholars. Alin sheba. The leaves. Elu ame ha'aretz. Rashi says, these are the people who work. The working class. The middle class. Knoknot sheba. The twigs. Elu Rekanish of Israel. Those are the Rishonim, the people who are bad. So behind it, the Shalchum Yisrael, Libay Rachamim, Iskali Al Aliyah. So they sent that the Talmidei Chachamim should daven for the working people, the leaves. Why should they daven for the working people? So here's what I'd like to say. The people who are at risk, they're a cunning Shabbat. The people who are not from, so there are Kiruv organizations, there are all sorts of chesed organizations who are right there ready to help them out. The rich people, they get all the help they need. They just pick up the phone and people come running. Talmidei Chachamim, Baruch Hashem, Talmidei Chachamim are taken care of, more or less. They get discounts of tuition, maybe, and all sorts of other things. They can pick up the phone and get people on the line. But the regular average person, nobody's out there to help. You're the people going through the daily grind. Nobody's looking out for you. You're not nebuch enough to be helped. You're not rich enough to be helped. It's our obligation to help each other. The Talmidei Chachamim are davening for you. The rich people should be making checks out to you. And people should be there helping us to take action. We want to take action. We're willing. Someone, please help us. So with that, afterwards we can talk about more challenges and more issues. Do we have, after benching, maybe we can have time for questions?
I just want to do some questions now.
I want to do questions now. I just want to mention that I've recently published a book, Search Engine, which is in the back. Feel free to look, take a look and buy it. It's at a discount here. You can buy it online as well. Does anyone have questions? Anyone want to ask something, talk, say something? Please, yes, Mr. Baum.
I think part of the problem that Orthodox is facing is that we're so concerned about looking over our shoulder and to be accepted.
I completely disagree with you, but I also fully agree with you. So the point was that we're too busy looking over our shoulder. And it's true. We should have confidence. We should recognize that we have a Mesorah, a tradition, modern Orthodoxy in particular, Orthodoxy in general. We have nothing to be ashamed of on the one hand. On the other hand, we believe in Klal Yisrael, which means we have to take care not to offend other people so that we can remain a unified, to some degree, community. Doesn't mean we have to give in. We don't have to be the suckers. There's no mitzvah to be a sucker. On the other hand, sometimes you got to compromise and you got to give them room to be with us, and they have to give us room to be with them. And sometimes it works on a personal level. So on the one hand, you're absolutely right. We have to be confident and we have to be assertive, because otherwise we'll get railroaded. We'll get steamrolled. On the other hand, we have to be welcoming and opening to people on our right and on our left. So I agree with you, but with the qualification.
You mentioned, spent a few minutes talking about 501c3 and how important that is. Can you be a little more specific in terms of community, what could be done, what should be done by an individual or group in the community the need for 501c3?
So why do we need a nonprofit? Why am I trying to start a nonprofit, something like that? So I'll tell you why. Because I'd like to hold conferences to talk about controversial issues from a modern Orthodox perspective. And in order to do that, I have to solicit donations. And I got to tell you, I went on one solicitation call, asked one person for money, and he took out a checkbook and said, how much do you need? So Baruch Hashem, we have people like that in the community. But I can't take the check, because I can't give him a tax break until I file all the right paperwork. And if I do it through a shul, there's all sorts of issues, unless the shul co-sponsors, because then they're just taking money from one place to another, tunneling. So there are issues on that. So if you want to do something in the community, and you want to create some sort of a program to help people, to educate, to create a network of people to help each other. So everyone needs money to do that. And people are willing to give, but we need to figure out how to do that. Maybe it's my personal ignorance that I don't know how, and it's just obvious.
I don't know.
Anyone else want to say anything before we? Please.
So I know people that are these outliers, and they go to rabbis, and the rabbis aren't on that page. They're giving them, advice as if these are normal cases. So what should they do? What should they tell my friends? What approach should they take?
So the challenge is not every leader, whether a rabbi or a community leader, is trained and capable to deal with every situation. And what rabbis really should know is when to refer to someone else. And I saw Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, people come to him with a question, and he would say, you want to ask that rabbi over there. Because he knew that the answer he was forced to give was not right for this person, and he wasn't willing to give them an answer that he wasn't personally comfortable with. So he referred them to someone else. So some people who are on the outskirts, the margins, or they don't necessarily, they're the people on the travelers on the muddy road, and they need a rabbi with expertise for those travelers, and you got to find the right rabbi. I live in Brooklyn, and I have the luxury of many shuls, and I could choose the shul with a rabbi who fits me. Not everybody has that luxury. And it's tough. It's challenging. Sometimes you need to find, we could talk afterwards, I could Maybe I could refer your friends to specific rabbis who are trained and capable of doing that. Someone ask a question, please? Leia.
Some people are positive and some people are negative. I think that I don't need politics. I don't need politics in the world because I think it's not a good idea to put that. Why did Abraham get a bris mila on Yitzhak and not the other one?
Why?
Yeah.
Do you have an answer?
Yeah. Because I don't want the politics on me and on the world that the governor says that why should we need politics in the world?
Wow. Leia, beautiful. I She summed up everything I tried to say beautifully. We should be positive. We shouldn't be negative. And when you're positive, you can solve problems in the world. Thank you very much.
We're going to have benching right now, and then Rabbi Student will be here for a few more moments. He has books for sale in the back, and I'm sure he will personally sign them.
Hey, Rabbi, can I just have your telephone number?
Namaste. Namaste. Namaste.